This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guests on Off the Shelf are Tom Barletta, he's a partner at Steptoe & Johnson, and Paul Hurst, who is of counsel at Steptoe & Johnson as well. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Roger. Nice to be here.
Hi, Roger. Thanks for having us.
Well, Tom and Paul, it's great to have you on. I'm looking forward to our conversation today. It's a topic that always engenders a lot of interest, and that's the Civil False Claims Act and what it means for government contractors and for the government as well. But first, Tom, I wanted to lay a little background here. Can you tell us a little bit about Steptoe and your government contracts practice?
Sure. Thank you. Steptoe is a Washington-based law firm. We have a full-service government contract practice. The things we do include bid protests, claims. We also have handled a number of Civil False Claims Act actions, as well as representing clients in connection with audits and investigations that can and sometimes do involve allegations of fraud. We also have a counseling practice where we advise clients on various compliance issues, including matters related to the GSA schedule and other business ethics and compliance requirements that are applicable to government contractors.
And we, and heaven knows there are lots and lots of those
there
out
certainly
there.
Are.
Yeah, it's it is a challenging environment for government contractors. And to that, Paul, can you talk? Let's get into the topic of the day, which I think impacts all those compliance issues that that we'll talk about a little bit later, and just overall performance of government contracts. You really, as a contractor, can't afford not to think about compliance, and that goes the Civil False Claims Act. What is the Civil False Claims Act, Paul?
Well, the Civil False Claims Act dates back to the Civil War era. It was passed during the Civil War, and it's intended to protect the government against fraud. It sat on the books for quite some time and wasn't used very often by the federal government until about the 1980s. And since then, it's been growing in significance to both the government as well as government contractors. Congress has amended it several times, particularly more recently in 1986, as well as in 2009, which essentially broadens the scope of the statute. But the statute imposes liability for submitting false claims to the government or making false statements to the government that are necessary to get paid.
That the government relies on in terms of paying, like, you know, the invoices that are submitted and that sort of thing. Is that right?
Right, exactly. Okay. Invoices, there's actually a number of theories which the government attempts to use to sort of fit within the Civil False Claims Act.
Right. So, and I'm a history buff, and I love Abraham Lincoln. He's, you know, I love the movie Lincoln, man. I've seen that about seven times. But so, you know, the law was passed. Why was it passed during the Civil War? Is it, as I understand it, there's a lot of essentially fraud in terms of government contracts for supporting the Northern war effort. Is that the reason?
That's right. I mean, the government found that it was often ordering and paying for goods, and they either weren't delivered or they were basically unusable. And so they enacted a statute to try and give the government a more effective remedy to prosecute contractors back at that time that weren't delivering what they were getting paid to deliver.
Right. It's again, as you mentioned, Paul, it's in during the 80s and 90s and now into the 21st century. It's led to quite a bit of payments by government contractors to the government for false claims. Is that right? I mean, I think you have some numbers.
That's right. I mean, every year the number of lawsuits filed under the False Claims Act have been increasing, and in 2012 alone, the government recovered over $5 billion under the Civil False Claims Act. That includes government contractors, but doesn't represent all government contractors alone.
Right. That included like Medicare and Medicaid.
Exactly. Medicare providers. That's really the target, but I think The growing significance of government contractors is there as well. It does represent a significant portion of that amount of money.
Well, can you tell us, okay, you know, what the statute provides and what's the legal standard for potential liability?
Sure. It submits. It requires the knowing submission of a false claim or a false statement. And the key there is what does the term knowing mean? It's basically defined three different ways. It's the intentional submission of a false claim, which would be obviously fraud. It also is defined to include reckless disregard and as well as deliberate ignorance. And both those standards are much easier to meet for the government than intent. And how the government can meet those standards is if a government contractor just ignores its requirements, you know, ignores what it's obligated to do under the contract, or ignores what it's obligated to disclose in terms of negotiating the price with the government. If that reaches a standard where it's essentially deliberate ignorance, you're sticking your head in the sand, then the government can make a case that that the contractor's committing fraud under the Civil False Claims Act.
Right, and I assume the government focuses on those second two prongs, right? The reckless disregard, or I mean,
deliberate ignorance or reckless disregard. And why do they focus on it? Because it's much easier to meet. I mean, the idea of establishing intentional commission or fraud is a very hard standard to meet, but those two other standards are much easier to meet, particularly when you've got government contractors and government regulations that impose all these requirements. They can point to those and say, well, this regulation required you to do this, this regulation required you to do that, and if you didn't do it, then they can make a case that that's reckless disregard or deliberate ignorance.
Right, and so, Tom, who can bring a Civil False Claims Act action?
Well, there's a variety of ways in which civil false claims action can arise. They can be brought by the United States Department of Justice based here in Washington. They can also be initiated by local U.S. attorneys. Many of those cases can arise out of audits or investigations conducted by agency inspector generals, such as the GSA, OIG. They can get information in those audits, which leads them to be concerned about potential fraud in connection with a government contract and refer the matter over to the Department of Justice. One of the more interesting wrinkles about the Civil False Claims Act is that Civil False Claims Act actions can also be brought by private individuals. These are called relators. The technical term is a quitam lawsuit, which means he who comes in the name of the king. But basically, this whistleblower provision of the FCA allows private individuals to file a civil false claims action essentially on behalf of the government. Once the case is filed, and the cases filed by the whistleblowers have to be filed under seal, which means in secret, the Justice Department then has an opportunity to decide whether or not it wants to basically assume responsibility for prosecuting the case or leave that to the relator. And usually the department's decision turns on its assessment of the merits of the case. If the government thinks it's a pretty good case, they will often take it over. If they're kind of uncertain or not persuaded, they'll leave it to the relator to prosecute. One indicator that, as I said, these civil false claims actions brought by relators are filed under seal and typically aren't unsealed until the government decides whether or not it's going to prosecute the case. But, you know, one indicator that a contractor could have that there's a Civil False Claims Act pending is that if it gets an IG subpoena, because
right.
the government sometimes uses those subpoenas to get information and documents that it then uses to decide whether or not
right.
this is a case that's attractive to it.
Right. You read my mind, Tom. I was going to ask you, like, how does the government decide, you know, what does it do? And it, I guess they do go through potentially an audit or an investigation on its own to make the determination about the merits of the quitam suit. Is that?
Typically, the lawyers from the U.S. Attorney's Office of the Department of Justice will, use information that's obtained in an audit or through a subpoena to make an assessment of the case. They'll often work with individuals from the IG's office to help them manage those documents and collect and organize that information. The decision by the government to take over an action is very significant because while there's not a lot of precise data, the data that's there suggests that where the government does proceed to take over the action, the chances of a significant recovery are much higher versus right. cases where it declines to take over the action and allows the relator to prosecute it. You know, there are can be opportunities for contractors in that period when the government is assessing the case to try and persuade the Department of Justice not to take it over. And that can be an important milestone if you're faced with one of these cases.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit more. But first, Paul, let's get the liability or the risk on the table. What are the potential penalties for violating the Civil False Claims Act?
They're pretty significant. I mean, not only do you get the government gets to recover damages, which is typically calculated as the price that the government paid for a good versus what it thinks it paid for the good. And we're assuming we're in a situation where it's maybe the contractor didn't disclose enough information about its pricing. The government's going to contend, well, if I knew X, Y, or Z, I would have paid much less. And then the government gets to treble their damages, which is effectively multiplied times 3. And that has a significant impact on the damages. And then on top of that, they get a penalty of anywhere between $5,500 to $11,000 per submission of a claim.
That in and of itself could add up to a lot of money if you're talking about a lot of invoices, right?
Exactly. And it typically is invoices, but I've seen attempts to sort of broaden the claim to include other submissions to the government, where they would say, well, that was a false statement that was necessary to get a claim paid, so that should also be a claim.
Be counted as well.
Right.
Even just not more than just the invoice, some performance reports or things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Expand wow. that, and it uses leverage to try to negotiate a better deal with the sure. contractor, but it quickly adds up.
Right. And right now, hey, Tom and Paul, we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Barletta and Paul Hurst. They are with the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson, and we'll continue our discussion on the Civil False Claims Act. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Tom Barletta and Paul Hurst. They are attorneys with Steptoe & Johnson, a law firm here in Washington, D.C. And guys, when you took the break, you were talking a little bit about, Paul, you mentioned, and we talked a little bit about invoices submitted and, in terms of potential damages, or $5,500 to $11,000 per submission to the government. So Tom, in that case, like, in the schedules context, GSA schedules, that could be lots and lots of transactions. Am I correct?
Potential exposure can be very significant, Roger, because when you think about it, under your GSA schedule contract, you're trying to make sales to a broad variety of user agencies, and each one of the invoices related to a sale or order under that contract could potentially give rise to at least an allegation that there was a false claim if your pricing on the GSA schedule itself is taken into question. And then, the schedule contracts have a very long term. I mean, they run for 5 years and can be renewed. And so you can be talking about a lot of invoices over a long period of time.
Right, up to 20 years. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. We've actually seen cases where the amount of money the government was asking for was actually more than the sales they'd made under their GSA schedule over the 10 years, because once you added the trebling, the penalties.
Sure, I can see how that could happen. Absolutely.
Right.
So, so you talk about the potential damages and what a contractor pays. Is that relate to, I'm trying to, the incentive for a relator or somebody who's a third party being able to to file a Civil False Claims Act? Can you talk what is their incentive to do?
Well, absolutely. Their incentive is to get part of the recovery. They can get anywhere between 15 to 25% of the recovery if the government intervenes. And that potentially even increases more if the government doesn't intervene and they have to prosecute the case on their own. They can up to 35% of the recovery. And that obviously turns into a lot of money. I mean, we're talking relators can recover millions of dollars for that process. And let's be honest, their attorneys recover part of that money as well. And so there's an incentive for plaintiff's attorneys to be out there looking for these types of cases.
Right. So, and Tom, can you, I know there's some significant settlements that, you're talking about that percentage that the relators may get or may not get. I mean, there's some big numbers, aren't there?
There are, Roger. I mean, most Civil False Claims Act actions settle at some point. And there have been any number of multi-million dollar settlements in civil false claims actions involving GSA schedule contracts, and some much larger settlements involving other contracts and in the healthcare context. In the context of the GSA world, one of the largest settlements was one from 2011, paid just under $200 million to settle a case where the government was alleging that it had made false statements in its CSPFs and had violated the price reduction clause in its GSA contract. Earlier this year, another company settled which is an industrial products company, settled an FCA case that also related to its GSA contract for something on the order of $70 million. And again, that case involved allegations of failure to provide, you know, complete sales and discount information in its CSPF. There have been other cases in the seven figures area, including cases involving the Trade Agreements Act, violations of the Trade Agreements Act, which requires, you know, you to sell basically products that are either U.S.
Sure,
made
sure.
or from a country where U.S. has a trade agreement. And so allegations of TAA noncompliance can also be a source of potential civil false claims liability.
Right. Well, there's a whole host of things to potentially navigate. Now, one of the things that sort of struck me in our first segment is you mentioned, Tom, you mentioned, you know, that this process where DOJ or the government, the federal government, takes a look at and tries to assess whether they're going to join in a relator's lawsuit. And it seems to me, if I'm a relator, you know, I guess I would want the government to intervene because my chances of success get much higher. So in the flip side of that is, if I'm a contractor in a situation where there's a potential action at me, I don't want DOJ to get involved. I want to be able to sort of address any concerns. How does that, I know you've dealt with that, you know, in your practice and advise clients, how does that work? I don't know how else to ask it.
We have, Roger, and it's probably best to describe it as a process. usually at some point.
Just like everything in government contract,
like
right?
Everything. Exactly. And it can be a very long process. You know, it's hard to say that there's a standard case, but, you know, it would not be atypical for you to be contacted by a U.S. attorney or a lawyer from the Department of Justice, for your client actually to be contacted. And basically, either it could be in the context of responding to a subpoena that I mentioned earlier, or after the government has received documents when it's analyzing those documents. And, you know, they basically will give you an opportunity to come in and have a conversation with them. It's a bit of a cat and mouse game that goes on, since if the QI-TAM complaint is filed under seal, they really can't tell you that there's a QI-TAM case pending. But
sure,
you can
yeah.
figure that out.
Right.
And, you know, the process is one where I think, you know, you have an opportunity to do a couple of things. One, to help educate the lawyers from the Department of Justice about the facts and circumstances surrounding your contract, and basically give them, you know, the other side of the story, because up to that point, they really have only seen, you know, one side of the story, either what the relator has alleged in his or her complaint or what's been identified in an audit. So it's an opportunity to explain to them, you know, your view of the case, to provide them with facts and information that they can use in analyzing the case, and to have a dialogue with them about the case. As I said, that process, you know, sometimes can be quite quick, because the government will conclude fairly quickly that it is or isn't interested, or it can, you know, Paul and I recently had a case that extended over a couple of years where that dialogue went on.
Now, I understand that there's also a criminal statute that's associated with. Can you tell us, we're not going to spend a lot of time in that, but what does that, I mean, you know, first, if you're a government contractor, you got to think about, you know, all the potential damages, the Civil False Claims Act, and which is really, frankly, tied to a certain extent to performance on your contract, that you've met all the terms and conditions. What's the criminal statute?
Well, there are several criminal statutes that the government can and sometimes does use involving government contracts. Those include, there's a Criminal False Statements Act, there's a Criminal False Claims Act, and then there's also a conspiracy statute. Any one or all of those can be arsenals, tools in the government's arsenal that they can bring to bear. There are situations that we've seen where the government has pursued both criminal and civil remedies simultaneously. I think, you know, more often than not, the Civil False Claims Act tends to be the tool of choice these days. I think in part because, as Paul said earlier, you know, the burden of proof is so much lower in a Civil False Claims Act, and the potential for significant monetary recovery is high. But I don't want to minimize the possibility that, given the right set of bad facts, the government might also try to invoke criminal penalties.
Right. And actually, sometimes we were talking earlier about the process where you're sitting down talking to the U.S. Attorney's Office, Department of Justice. Sometimes you don't know whether it's on the civil side or the criminal side, and they won't tell you.
Right.
And so you have to, it does require you to carefully navigate those communications, because if it is a criminal investigation, it might change the way you present information versus if it's a civil case.
Right. And right now we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Tom Barletta and Paul Hurst. They are with the law firm of Steptoe and Johnson, and we'll continue our discussion on the Civil False Claims Act. I think we'll turn a little bit to GSA schedules. You mentioned some settlements that involve the GSA schedules, and talk a little bit about, you know, what those terms and conditions are and that raise those issues when we come back. But you right now, you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
These days, it seems everyone's talking about the new normal, but federal agencies have a chance to define it. How will you shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. We understand what makes America work and how it can work better. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we can help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, or even change the game. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Tom Barletta and Paul Hurst. They are with the law firm of Steptoe and Johnson. And guys, when we took the break, I think I mentioned we might start talking a little GSA schedules and what the, I guess, the lay of the land there is and what the key risk areas are. So I'll open it up. Yeah, Paul, Tom, whoever can start. I mean, there's plenty of targets and opportunity there.
Well, I'm sure as every government GSA schedule contractor knows, there's something called the commercial sales practices format that you have to complete at the beginning of your contract period, as well as at each opportunity to extend it. And that is obviously one of the key areas where there's risk for Civil False Claims Act liability, because it requires the contractor to disclose their commercial sales practices in full across the board in terms of all categories of customers. As written, it's quite broad, and also requires the contractor to disclose its absolute best prices that is offered to other customers, even non-comparable customers, so the government can get a sense of what their commercial sales practices are. And if all that data is not there, then it's ripe for the picking later on for the government to come back and say, well, you didn't disclose this. You then submitted false claims because you didn't disclose all your data. It requires complete and accurate disclosure. And as a result, if we'd known all this information you hadn't disclosed, we would have gotten negotiated a much better price. And that's where you get in the situation that Tom was talking about, where all of a sudden, retroactively, they're going back 10 years saying we could have gotten a 50% discount as opposed to the 40% discount that we negotiated. And that starts to add up.
Right. And Paul, is that a continuing obligation? Like if a contractor's prices policies change during performance, it's at any time, right?
Well, I think we would say that it's not a continuing obligation unless you have a new price action that you'd have to disclose. But I think the government would take a different point of view. They would say, well, wait a second, you knew this contract was premised on these disclosures. If you had a significant change in your commercial sales practices, you should have disclosed those.
Right.
But the problem, there's often opportunities during the contract to add products, extend the contract, and that's where you're going to have a new obligation to disclose.
And related to that is, you know, the price reduction clause, because, you know, there you have an obligation to essentially disclose to the government any price reductions that are afforded to your basis of award customer. And if you fail to do that, the government can take the position and has taken the position that had you made that, you know, disclosure, then it would have gotten a lower price. And by failing to do that, it's paid a higher price than it would have. And therefore, you know, you've again violated the Civil False Claims Act.
You know, something about the price reduction clause that I have to talk a little bit about. It seems to me it's, you know, because the statutes have and the regulations governing the schedules program have fundamentally changed, in that, you know, there's now a statutory and regulatory requirement for competition at the order level, right? For any, anything over $150,000, you have to provide notice to all the contractors and provide them opportunity to compete. And to me, that sort of, that's directly contrary to the idea of a price reduction clause, because here the pricing is now being driven by competition under the contract itself at the task order level, whereas before you've had this price reduction clause that is based on transactions completely outside, the scope of that contract or private commercial transactions to try to drive pricing. And it seems like the price reduction clause hasn't caught up with the regulatory framework. Does that make sense?
It does. It actually kind of mirrors some conversations we've actually had with government lawyers, because I think at the stage where you're initially negotiating what the price should be, you don't have a requirement whatsoever.
Absolutely.
And so our argument to the government at that point is saying, well, this was a fair price negotiated at a correct discount, because at that point they had no idea of how much product the government would purchase, and the price wouldn't really be negotiated until an order came down. The government's response to that is, we would have just negotiated even better discounts when the order came through. And so they would ratchet us down during the negotiations of what the liability is under Civil False Claims Act, and just say,
so they really, they actually, that's a position. That's interesting.
They would have said, if you disclose X, Y, and Z, they would have negotiated a much better price. And then when the order comes through, they would have even gone lower. And that increases their opportunity to argue that damage would be higher. Tom, is that a fair summary?
That's a fair summary, Paul.
Wow, I'm amazed.
It's interesting. I mean, it's exactly the dialogue we have. And I think one interesting thing is you're often dealing with U.S. attorneys or Department of Justice lawyers who don't regularly deal in GSA schedule, particularly if you're outside of the D.C. area.
Sure.
You've got a U.S. attorney in Washington, and you have to educate them first on those requirements, but then they look at it a different perspective than how you just described it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to me, it's price is driven by the unique requirement at the place and time under the order, and that's the market, not somehow you're going to lower price. That doesn't make any economic sense to me.
None. And I think from a commercial business standpoint, you could very, very much with a straight face argue, why would any contractor offer their best discount in exchange for nothing?
Right.
A potential.
Right. To compete for stuff.
Yeah.
To compete for stuff
with no minimum, really no real minimum sales under the contract.
Well, you guys know that's one of my favorite talks.
Exactly.
right? Price reduction clause. But Tom, you talked a little bit about the Trade Agreements Act earlier and the compliance issues there. So what is the Trade Agreements Act, and what are the concerns?
Well, the Trade Agreements Act is a statute that basically gives a preference to products from certain countries. And it essentially requires the government to buy products that are either, to oversimplify a bit, either made in the United States or made in what's called a designated country, which is a country with which the United States has a trade agreement. And, in the world we live in today, there are significant sources of supply, namely China and India, which are countries that with which we don't have trade agreements, and which therefore the government is not supposed to be, acquiring. And so that if you are selling product, for example, under a GSA schedule contract that's not manufactured in the U.S. or a designated country, there's potential exposure. And as I said earlier, there have been a number of significant settlements arising out of alleged noncompliance with this Trade Agreements Act.
Okay, so I got, I think, one last area, and either one of you guys take a shot at it, but, there's a lot of these issues now involving service contracts, acts, and it can be not just on the schedules, but, it could be a GWAC or whatever. It's whether people, meet the labor qualifications of the labor categories on the contract when they're actually performing. I think that's been an area where there's been growing sort of oversight. What is that all about?
Well, I think if you look at it maybe from a somewhat overly simplistic view, the government is contracting, at least from its perspective, for, in this case, services of a certain quality as reflected in, the qualifications of the people in a labor category. And I think, the government's position would be that if, for example, you have a labor category where the individual is supposed to have a master's degree and 15 years of experience, and you wind up filling the position with a person who doesn't meet those qualifications, but billing them at the labor rate associated with that labor category, that it's not getting what it's paid for, and that, you know, therefore the invoice is false. And so it's really no different from a lot of other aspects of government contracting, which is really to ensure that, you know, what you're providing is what's called for under the contract and is being priced accordingly.
That's, to me, it raises some interesting questions, because oftentimes the people who are best at their job don't have the qualifications that are in the contract, or they're the government specifically asks for an individual because they know they can get the job done and they don't meet the qualifications. That's sort of a difficult situation for a contractor.
Well, it can be, but then don't forget that, you know, one thing contractors can think about doing is being sure that the government knows what you're doing. I mean, it's one thing if you go to your customer and say, you know, you want person X, and, you know, you should be aware that this person doesn't exactly meet those qualifications, and create a record of that, you know, I'll call it disclosure or communication, so that if later on an auditor comes and looks at it, you can say, yes, this was the qualification, but my customer knew and understood what it was getting when it asked for, you know, person X to be placed on this job.
Right. That's great. That's great advice, Tom. And right now we do have to take our last break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more with Tom Barletta and Paul Hurst of Steptoe & Johnson, and we'll started the conversation about how do you protect yourself from all these statutes and the Civil False Claims Act and how they tie together, and also talk a little bit about the mandatory disclosure rule. And you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
The mission of government involves critical efforts to improve national defense, economic security, health services, and citizens' lives. The strategy and technology consultants of Booz Allen Hamilton are proud to help government address cyber threats, reform the financial system, modernize infrastructure, and protect our nation. For nearly 100 years, Booz Allen has partnered with clients to deliver results that endure. To see Booz Allen's ideas in action, visit BoozAllen.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guests are Tom Barletta and Paul Hurst. They are from the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson. And guys, it's our last segment, and first I want, we've talked a lot, focused on the Civil False Claims Act specifically, and the penalties associated with it and that sort of thing. But what are the? I know there are other risks associated with potential FCA actions.
Well, one of the principal things, Roger, that a contractor needs to be aware of is that if you get involved in a Civil False Claims Act action, you're likely to, at some point, be having a conversation with the agency suspension and debarment official. Losing a Civil False Claims Act case is a cause for debarment, and even where the case is settled, the agency suspension and debarment official is likely to want to have a conversation with you and ask you to come in and demonstrate why you are presently responsible. And that discussion is going to include things like whether you took appropriate disciplinary action against people involved in the underlying conduct, and whether you've implemented new procedures, policies, and controls to ensure that the conduct that occurred doesn't happen again.
With that, Paul, I did want to touch on, like, what are some of the key features of a good compliance program that contractors need to have in place when they think about the, performance and their obligations under any federal government contract.
Right. And I guess I would focus on the GSA schedule. I mean, the first step commercial sales practices. I mean, it is designed to attract commercial companies to contract with the government, but this is not the commercial world. You've got to understand that it imposes strict requirements, particularly in terms of the disclosures up front for the commercial sales practices.
It sounds to me like a lot of it, too, is training your sales force and training folks. Is that kind of thing that you guys have done for people before?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've got to have a good compliance officer or a compliance program in place, have written policies that everyone understands, and have regular training. And we've done that, but they can also do it internally. I also think that part of your compliance is understand what you're not telling the government. And think about, as Tom mentioned earlier, documenting certain things. If you're in the commercial sales practices area, think about what are the things you're not disclosing the government. Do you have limitations in your data collection? Tell them about that. And so they're negotiating with full information, and you can point to those disclosures later on.
And one thing I'd add, Roger, is that, as Paul said, the objective of the schedules program is to attract commercial companies. And for companies that are truly commercial and don't otherwise do business with the government, the requirements of a GSA contract can be quite challenging, because there's a real cultural difference there. And you know, notions about limiting price reductions you can afford to customers in order to get a sale are a little bit, you know, counterintuitive in the commercial marketplace.
Right. It's sort of, it's the anti-commercial commercial contracting program, right? Right. I mean, it's, there's no other program that I know of that actually makes it harder for a government, for a contract. I mean, maybe there is a government contract program that makes it harder for contractors to do business in the private sector, right?
But the challenge is really from a contractor's perspective to be sure that your people, both on the commercial side and on the government side, understand what the obligations of the contract are. Because as Paul said, failure to do that can be used as evidence of either reckless disregard or deliberate ignorance.
Yeah, and these days there's a new feature, and it's not new anymore. We're coming up, I think, on the fifth anniversary of implementation of the mandatory disclosure rule and the clauses around that, which do in part imply to commercial item contracts. I always just say, hey, even if, you know, it's only part of the clause, when you look at that clause, it's a roadmap for your compliance program, whether you're a commercial item contractor or just a traditional government contractor. So can you talk a little bit about the mandatory disclosure rule and what it entails?
Sure. Roger, you're exactly right. That clause is a roadmap for your compliance program, whether you're a commercial contractor or whether you are a, you know, traditional cost-based, you know, weapon system contractor. The disclosure rule went into effect in December of 2008. It's similar but not identical to a clause that was first put in place in 2007, and there had been a series of truly voluntary disclosure programs that different inspector general's offices had in place prior to that. As you suggested, you know, it really applies to all contractors, and it's part of a broader, you know, policy or direction that is reflected in the FAR that emphasizes the need for contractors to conduct themselves with honesty and integrity, have a written code of business conduct and compliance training, and also to have, you know, adequate internal controls. The disclosure provision is at FAR 52-203-13. And, you know, what it provides is really that you have to, if you find credible evidence of a violation of either certain provisions of Title 18, for example, fraud, conflicts of interest, briberies, or gratuities, or of the Civil False Claims Act, that you need to make a written disclosure to the IG of the agency involved with a copy to the contracting officer. You know, as a practical matter, the regulations also require disclosure of significant overcredit where you have credible evidence of significant overpayments, because FAR subpart 9.4 makes knowing failure to disclose overpayments a cause for debarment. Failure to make a disclosure of credible evidence of a violation of Title 18 or the Civil False Claims Act is itself a cause for suspension and debarment.
Right. So credible evidence is that, I mean, to me, that strikes me as that's where you as a contractor, if you have something, you know, you have your own hotline or whatever, and it's reported internally, you have to do your due diligence to figure out whether, in fact, there is credible evidence or not. Is that where sometimes in-house counsel or outside counsel come in and take a look at the situation and provide advice? Is that how that works?
That has to be part of your compliance program. I mean, basically what you need to do when you basically have something like a hotline report or have come across other evidence of possible irregularities is, I think what you need to do is do due diligence, as you suggested, which includes, you know, basically taking a look at collecting relevant information, possibly talking to people who are involved, and, you know, deciding whether or not there's essentially sufficient evidence that suggests that there, you know, is essentially a possible violation of one of those statutes. It's something that, you know, larger companies probably have a compliance function, either internal audit or under the auspices of a compliance counsel that do that. But if you don't have those kinds of functions established, you need to either look to outside counsel or, you know, identify some other way to do it. But you can't basically ignore evidence of irregularities.
Yeah, I guess I would, you know, credible evidence is not defined. And I think the government would have one perspective that
absolutely
of what credible evidence is that perhaps we might not all agree with. But that's something you have to think about.
That's why we need lawyers, right?
Exactly.
And I think if you do conclude that you have credible evidence, then, you know, you do have an obligation to make a disclosure. And, you know, going back to this due diligence process, you know, what the government doesn't want to see is some threadbare disclosure. They want you to provide sufficient information about what happened, who was involved. And I would say you should also include information about any remedial actions you've taken in light of what you've seen. And then, you know, what will typically happen is that, you know, the IG to whom you make a disclosure will, conduct an investigation, and that will probably involve, requests for additional documents and information, and you need to be prepared to, cooperate in that investigation.
Right. So that's great advice. And, we're coming up at the end of the show, Tom, and I know you, we were talking about this quote and just sort of what I think really sums up, the Civil False Claims Act and how it all works in government contracts. So I wanted to give you a chance to let the audience hear that this quote.
Sure. Roger, this is a quote from Professor Ralph Nash at GW Law School, who's one of the deans of the government contracts bar. And he was commenting on the outcome of another Civil False Claims Act case that involved effective pricing. And this is what he concluded, and I think the message is a good one at the end of the day. He said, "Only in the world of government procurement can a customer that believes it has devised a procurement technique that drives prices down then assert claims against the contractor to extract even more money. The reason that this can and does occur is that the government is not a single entity, but, in Ralph's words, a many-headed monster. Satisfying one head does not mean that another head will not bite you. Contractors, and this is the important point, contractors have to protect themselves from all of these heads, and the only way to do that is to be squeaky clean and honest in every interaction with government officials. It's a tough assignment, but it's the only way to play the game." I think that's really, as you said, sums up where we are today and what contractors need to keep their eye on.
Yeah, and on that note, I want to thank my guests, Tom Barletta and Paul Hurst. They are attorneys with the law firm of Steptoe & Johnson, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.